Hello, and welcome back to the Trotters for One podcast. I'm Jonathan.
And I'm Elizabeth.
And we are talking with you from our concrete box in Phnom Penh, Cambodia, on a Wednesday afternoon. It's good to meet with you again.
Hey, you guys.
So, this episode, episode 3, we're going to talk about anxiety and OCD. So it's going to be a lot of fun. but before we do that, we thought we would start with questions from the box. A while ago, not concrete box, although that's that too. It's a little glass box called Table Topics that a friend of us, actually, Elizabeth's sister, gave us a couple years ago. We use it as a family conversation starter all the time. I'm going to give the box to Elizabeth, and she's going to read a question, and then I'll answer it, and then she'll answer it. And we're going to try to do this every episode. We'll call it something snazzy, like questions from the box. Okay. All right. Here it goes.
All right. Which of your five senses would you be saddest to lose?
Oh, come on.
I know, that's hard.
I don't like this game. Which of the five senses would you be saddest to lose? Okay, you go first.
That's really hard. I would be really sad to lose my sense of hearing, I think.
Oh, interesting. I think I'd go with sight, because that impacts your life a lot.
It does, but without hearing, you can't sing.
Okay. I don't know. We'll see if we continue with the questions from the box or not.
Singing is important. We could try another one.
Sure.
Ooh, what's one thing you've done that you'd like to erase?
Oh, come on.
They're all hard.
We'll save that for next time. Start a podcast, huh? All right, questions from the box. So, what is it about anxiety and OCD you want to start with, Elizabeth?
Well, first of all, I want to say that these have been problems I dealt with really in depth over the last year, 2 years, but they've been with me my whole life. I just didn't have a name for it. I didn't know what I was dealing with was, some of what I was dealing with was OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, which is in the family of anxiety disorders. But when a counselor helped us pinpoint that's what my particular variety of anxiety was, it made sense because I could see that throughout my life. I could see little, especially when I started reading more about it, obsessively counting things, obsessively checking things. I could just see traces of it throughout my life. And then, of course, anxiety and worry have been there for many years. So, and I've written about that a lot before, but this past year I just had more specific names for them and more specific tools to fight them.
So, I mean, you're not a therapist, and neither am I. I work as a pastoral counselor. What gives you the right to talk about anxiety or OCD on a podcast?
No more than anyone else who's gone through it and read a bunch and found the reading to be helpful when they applied it to their life.
Okay. Yeah. And I mean, I work as a pastoral counselor, so I've done some reading as well, but I've not lived through it as the person experiencing anxiety, OCD. I will talk a little bit later, though, of course, how this impacted us and our relationship and how I tried to help and maybe sometimes failed in helping. In general, anxiety is the umbrella term, right?
Yeah.
And underneath anxiety is OCD, is panic, is generalized anxiety. Is there anything else that you remember?
Well, I also have health anxiety, so like hypochondria, that might be in a different umbrella, but sometimes they get grouped together.
So at the beginning, what would you say, Elizabeth, is there anything hopeful for somebody if they're just listening to this and they're like, oh, shoot, I think I do have anxiety. And sometimes cross-cultural living brings out a lot of anxiety. And a lot of our listeners are living in cross-cultural situations, maybe in environments that are harder, they're dirtier, they're more chaotic because they're just not used to them. Mm-hmm. Or maybe because objectively they are more chaotic and with more diseases and things. Is there hope at the beginning of this podcast? Is there hope for somebody like that?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Why?
Because I think I applied these steps kind of slowly. Or I actually applied them, I tried to apply them all at once, but they didn't all take effect at once, so it took a while to feel the results, but I eventually did. And I actually had a lot of anxiety and fear before we moved overseas, and I worked through a lot of that, you know, 10 years ago or so. And I lived really anxiety-free for, you know, the first 6 years of living overseas. And then it just kind of came back again. So I just had to relearn how to deal with it. I think I needed to learn new ways of dealing with it. So I definitely think that you can work through it and live much more calmly.
That sounds like fun.
Yeah.
Well, where do you want to start then? With your own story or with some resources or what?
Well, I think something that people don't always talk about in church circles is practical things. Mm-hmm. And this is where the counselor started with me when I saw someone earlier this year.
Yay for counselors.
Yay, yeah.
How about just don't be anxious for anything? Be anxious.
And I feel like we already know those verses, yeah, and we know the right church answers. And, I mean, I've memorized Matthew 6, the last part of it, several times in my life, and it has been very helpful. And it always has a new meaning every time. We're memorizing it as a family again right now. So it's not to minimize spiritual teaching, but just that sometimes it's like you know all the right answers and you know the Bible verse, and it's just like you're not getting anywhere. And I was in a kind of, I was in a pretty low spot when I saw someone earlier this year. I had kind of put off seeing someone because I had a lot of shame associated with seeing someone. For my problems, I have seen counselors before. I've had no problem with that. But this time, the anxiety was causing issues between us in our marriage, and that felt really shameful because I'm married to the marriage counselor and he works with marriages across the city, sometimes the country and sometimes the world, people from other countries. And I just thought I couldn't let anyone know that I was having problems in my marriage.
I don't want to interrupt you.
So I put
it
off.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I want to mention, you said that there was a lot of shame for you around anxiety. Do you think that that's a common experience for Christians or cross-cultural workers who have anxiety on the one hand, but then also experience a tremendous amount of shame because they're not supposed to have anxiety?
Oh, totally. I mean, I think we have shame around almost anything.
Okay.
Around all of the problems we have because we think we're not supposed to have them.
Yeah.
And if you're living on support, or you're kind of on this pedestal for your sending church, you don't feel like you can say what your problems are.
Yeah. You've always done that.
I've always said what my problems are. And I was, and I referenced the anxiety earlier on, but I didn't talk a lot specifically about it. And I certainly wasn't talking about the nitty gritty parts, how it affected my day-to-day life. And so I got to a really low place, a really low place, because I think anxiety can kind of trigger depression, because anxiety is this really, your body and your mind are on high alert all the time, and you just can't really, like, live with that for a long period of time. So you start to slow down at some point. And I'd had a really bad day, and I was Skyping my best friend in the States. I've known her almost as long as we've been married. Mm-hmm. And we had scheduled this before, but she was just asking me how I was, and I just kind of broke down, told her I'm not okay. I cried a lot, couldn't stop crying. And she said, okay, you need to call someone. You need to get help. And, I finally did. Yeah.
She pushed pause for you and said,
yeah.
I think I remember that conversation, and I was like, oh, okay,
yeah, because you'd been asking me to see someone for a while, but
it doesn't always work when his spouse is pushing or pressuring.
Yeah.
Although I tried. So
and
what
so
did you
I did.
Do?
So I did. I finally reached out to someone, and she was able to squeeze me in, someone who worked at the same counseling center that you work at. Yeah. And I went in and I'm not sure what I was expecting, but the first session really focused on practical things. And I'm really glad she started with that because she asked me things like, what do you do for fun? And I wasn't doing things for fun. I said, well, we, as in our family, and I listed a couple things, and she interrupted and said, no, not we, you.
What do you do for fun?
Yeah, what do you do?
And well, that might be a place to ask our listeners if that's something that you're wrestling with, is to really jot that question down and consider it. What are you doing, you know, not just for rest, not just for your family, but what are you personally doing for fun?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't remember. Did that cause you to start doing anything for fun?
Well, there was another part of the conversation about keeping track of the wins, I think.
Wins as in like the not good the things, losses, but the wins.
Yeah. And so that very day, I went to a store and bought a notebook, and that was going to be my anxiety battle notebook. And I was going to keep a list of good things in there because I was so down, only focusing on negative things. And it started really slowly. And over time, I was able to have more and more good things.
Yeah.
So she started with the practical, and then I tried to go out by myself, just go out to read for coffee. And it's not that I didn't know what she was talking about. It was that I had forgotten. How to take care of myself, to do good things for myself. Because when you're so low, you can't make yourself do something fun. You can't make yourself leave the house. Everything seems stressful and overwhelming.
Do you feel like she gave you permission to do that, or not?
Yeah, I think so, okay. In a way. Yeah. And also just reminded me that I needed to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt like that was really helpful. Mm-hmm. So I kind of worked on that for a couple weeks before I saw her again.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really helpful in pulling me out of the really deep, deep slump.
Okay. People are going to be wondering, what does a really deep, deep slump look like? Because, mm-hmm. I mean, I'm married to you, mm-hmm. and I knew that you were sad and you were anxious a lot. So it's taking mm-hmm. up a lot of mental energy.
Mm-hmm.
But you're still doing your job. You're still teaching the kids at home, and you're mm-hmm. educating 4 kids. We're still going to church. You're still interacting socially at the homeschool co-op.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you are still fully functioning. And some people maybe aren't if they get to mm-hmm. a really, really low spot.
Mm-hmm.
So it can be kind of hard to see from the outside.
Mm-hmm.
But I just think it's important to note that what was happening on the inside of you, you're describing as really, really low.
Mm-hmm.
But somebody outside might not have seen it because you're still showing up and functioning on par. You're still writing, or not much, you weren't not writing much during that time, but you're mm-hmm. still sort of collecting articles and you're still doing your job.
Yeah.
What do you think about that? I mean, how would you, does that sound
but
right,
I wasn't or? The same person at home.
Well,
I wasn't
I
doing as, I wasn't doing the fun things with the kids, playing games, reading books to them. My thought life was just all taken up by all my worries.
And a lot of our conversations were taken up by...
That's true.
We stopped having some of the fun conversations, and a lot of our conversations were about worries.
Yeah.
And fears.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All the things I was afraid of, that I was freaking out about all the time, and
all the
texting
time.
You all the time
all
about
the time.
All the things I was scared of. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, one time I think a couple times we had to have a conversation where I was like, hey, I'm at work, please, unless something's like really, really going on, wait, I can't do this.
So that was happening.
That's hard stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and I just want to say to the listeners, if you're in that spot, that really is a hard spot for the person who's in the middle of it and for the spouse. I think it's harder for the person who's in it, of course. It can be a bit blinding, but yeah, that for what it's worth, and we see you, we know that that is a really rough place to be, and there might not be a lot of people who see it,
mm-hmm.
Because you might still be functioning, you might still be able to do your job, But man, it feels really bad on the inside.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say to that person, Elizabeth?
I would say to reach out to someone. And I did have a few friends that I was talking to about this at throughout last fall. I had some friends who would listen to me and talk to me about that, and they were really valuable to me. I think I still needed outside help. I still needed a counselor. But I did have a few people in real life who knew what was going on, and I'm glad. I'm thankful for them, and they know who they are.
Yeah. And I think, you know, oftentimes people will just Google things, and I often tell clients, if you're Googling something that is about emotions or that is about God or something like that, look around, and if you can, keep track of your Google search and then ask a person in real life, a person that you know in real life. And I think that you did that, Elizabeth. You got to a spot where the cost of reaching out was less than the cost of staying.
Yeah.
And you reached out. Not everybody has a counseling center in their town, especially if they're cross-cultural workers. So what should they do?
Well, sometimes you can find people who'll Skype with you.
Sure.
You can try to reach out to someone in your organization, but usually that gets weird. And organizations know that. Yeah. And so sometimes there are these like third party places. I think we have a list of counseling centers on the Life Overseas page.
Life Overseas I think there's a resource page from the homepage of a Life Overseas. Some of the counseling centers do offer distance-based professional counseling services. Some of them don't, but it's worth inquiring about. We are going to put a list on our website in this episode with some book resources, and we'll throw that in as well, the link to the resource page on A Life Overseas.
So
okay, what else?
Yeah, so there were, I kind of in some ways tried to do a bunch of it on my own, and so I'll just tell you a list of things that did end up being really helpful.
So what was not helpful?
And what was not helpful?
And I know that I did some things that were not helpful, and I'm sorry about that. What are some things that were not helpful?
Well, okay, so Google is not helpful.
Oh, Google is not your friend.
Google is not your friend. And because you can just, whatever you're anxious about, you can Google it, and then there's just so much anxiety on the internet because everything could kill you. I just feel like everything is seizure, coma, death.
Everything could kill you.
Everything could kill you.
Yes.
So, and you can like run down a rabbit trail and find other kind of anxious sounding information. And I did find some helpful things online, of course, because that's where I learned about, you know, better nutrition and exercise and stuff like that. But Google also can be a bad thing.
It's a black hole.
Yeah.
Unless you're looking for the one thing.
Yeah. And it can make me more scared, because if a lot of my anxiety is about health-related concerns. So if you can Google something and then like bad things could happen. It could be nothing, but it could be something really bad. So it can be bad.
So that's not helpful. Google's not helpful. What else is not helpful?
Well, I just feel
for you.
Like,
I mean, this may not be true across the board, but for you.
I feel like guilt and shame are not helpful. So I knew that I had problems and I could not fix them myself. I was trying and I could not. And
I was trying too.
But then on top of that, I knew that I was basically ruining your life.
Aww.
So it was like all this pressure about I need to fix myself so that I can be better and so that my husband can be better.
Aww.
So like, I think that was, you asked about what you did that was maybe not helpful. And I don't know if you like purposely tried to make me feel bad. It was just that when I knew that you were in a bad place, because I was in a bad place, I just took that all myself. It's like, I'm ruining everything.
Yeah.
And when there was, that was piled on top, so I never could get out of it. It was like, it was like burying me even deeper.
Yeah. Sorry.
Okay. We didn't know what we were doing.
I know we've talked about this before. This is not the first time. If you're listening, this is not the first time that I've become aware of how I did not do that all right. So you're saying the guilt and shame, pressure, of course.
Yeah.
And I know that there was a huge drive in me to sort of make you get better so that I would feel better.
Hmm.
And a book that really helped me in that was called, I had that written down.
When Someone You Love?
Loving Someone with Anxiety. Loving Someone with Anxiety. And it was really helpful for me to give me the tools to stay present with you while not trying to fix you or not trying to... without the need to fully understand what you were fearing or what you were, you know, going through, to be able to say, I love you, I care about this, I'm also going to go out, I'm going out for coffee by myself, mm-hmm. and to have some space, and that was really helpful for me.
Mm-hmm.
And in this time, I also reached out to a couple of older mentors of mine to say, hey, can we talk? I need to say everything in a safe place,
mm-hmm.
everything that's going on. And that was a real big pivot point for me, too. So then I had some support specifically around this with guys who were not throwing you under the bus. They weren't like,
mm-hmm.
it wasn't a judge fest or anything, but they could walk alongside of me because at that time you were not able to walk alongside of me.
Right.
And I was having a hard time walking alongside of you too.
Mm-hmm.
They helped me. And then we want to just kind of put that in the past, but that's a real big part of our story.
Yeah.
I don't know anything you want to add to that about your experience with having a spouse who maybe doesn't understand the anxiety hole that you're in?
Well, I think one of the best things you did was talk to your friends.
Okay, yeah.
Because you felt better supported. And you wanted to make sure I supported that, and I did. I knew that I needed extra support. So I was reaching out to people, and you needed extra support too.
Yeah.
So usually, like 19 years of marriage, most of the time we're each other's support.
Yeah.
And so that was like a real big shift for that time. And that was really hard.
And I would say that we're back to that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you
think? Oh, totally. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think it's important even for people to understand even if your marriage has been a really strong place for the majority of the time, there may come a time when you both need outside support. In fact, that's... You have to be able to reach out
mm-hmm.
for support that is outside,
yeah.
For those moments specifically, even if they're not the majority of the time. And maybe for some people they will be the majority of the time. I mean, maybe for some they do need outside support the majority of them, you know, most of the time.
Yeah, or you're in what one of the people I've read called maintenance.
Mm.
Just kind of the attitude that anxiety and OCD, which is one thing I deal with also, that they never completely go away.
Mm.
You still have to use your tools. You still have to do the steps
yeah.
of things to deal with them. And I kind of liken it to that. There's this movie. It came out when we were first married. It was called A Beautiful Mind.
Mm.
And it was about this brilliant mathematician. I think he won some big award at some point. But he had mental illness. I think he had schizophrenia.
I think so.
And he heard voices. The movie portrayed it as if he saw visions, but in real life, I think he only heard voices, but you have to portray it visually. So he does not believe that these visions that he has of these people are false for so much of the movie, even when he is in a mental hospital and they're trying to treat him. He finally comes to understand that. But the very last scene, you see him walking in a garden, and you see the three or four people who were part of his delusions, and they're off to the side, and they're kind of like walking with them. It's like he sees them, and they see him, and they're acknowledging each other, but he's not going to listen to them anymore. And this was several months ago when I kind of got that picture in my mind. This is what working with OCD and anxiety is like, because there's always going to be these like little whispers of something,
mm-hmm.
and you have to be able to look at it and acknowledge it and say, I'm not inviting you into my real life. I'm not going to actually listen to you or converse with you, but I know you're still there.
Mm-hmm.
You can't pretend like it's not there.
Yeah. So do you want to talk about resources and
yeah,
books?
Sure. Yeah. Before we go into the books, I will just list a few really practical things that I found to be helpful. One of the most practical things, most important thing for me is exercise.
Yeah.
And I've known this for many years, even before I really kind of spiked into this terrible, terrible time, that I need hard exercise every other day. Or every day, but not always every day, but at least every other day. And it has to be hard. It has to be weight training or like a pretty intensive cardio or some sort of interval training.
Now, the question is, I mean, I know your exercise routine because I see it here.
Mm-hmm.
People might be imagining that that means you go to the gym or you go run 5 miles. We live in Phnom Penh. It's a little bit harder to do that.
Yeah, I have videos. I have DVDs or I use YouTube. Yep. Mm-hmm.
So for
I
you,
do it in my house.
So that happens in the schoolroom, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Your hard cardio. So I would just encourage listeners to don't
assume you have to have a gym.
Don't assume that you can't do it if you live in an urban area without access to a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's not your preferred way of working out. Maybe a DVD is not it, but but if that's all you got, it might be worth it. So, don't negate that.
I know there are gyms here, but this just worked for me ever since my kids were little, and then I didn't have to worry about babysitting.
Okay.
So I can feel the difference.
Yeah.
So, and I'm much happier.
So can we all.
Yeah. So can we all.
Yeah, and that's true for me too. In one way, that exercise helps me be happy. But yeah.
And I change the way I ate. So I cut out caffeine because caffeine can increase your anxiety. So that meant giving up coffee. That was very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't happy while I was doing it.
But you didn't make me give up coffee.
No, I didn't make
that.
You give up coffee. Thank goodness for decaf because it's fun to go on dates and still drink coffee together.
Right.
And I increased the amount of protein and fat that I ate because our neurotransmitters require a lot of protein to be, I'm not a medical expert, but it's my understanding that all of our hormones, they need enough fat and enough protein to make them. And you want everything like kind of humming along in your body and in your brain as well as possible. So like give your body the right building blocks to make what it needs.
Yeah. So eat more fat.
healthy fats. And I cut out the sugar too. Cause when you have low blood sugar, it really, it can mimic like panic attacks. So in your body. So, or it can like trigger them. So, so you have to watch that. So those are some really practical things that I had to do. I also learned how to triangle breathe, which is fabulous.
Yeah.
It really works. You taught me how to do it. You can explain it. Yeah.
It's a powerful way of breathing that blends some physiological changes with some mindfulness practices, because you're focusing on breathing. You can conceptualize it as a triangle where you slowly breathe in through your nose for 4 or 5 seconds, you hold it for 4 or 5 seconds, whatever, and then you let it out slowly out through your mouth. You can Google or look up on YouTube triangle breathing. Some of it will be real frou-frou, real weird sort of Eastern religion. But what I always encourage people to do is you can actually watch your heart rate drop when you do it, because you're stimulating these systems in your body that say, oh, we need to slow down the heart rate. We need to lower the blood pressure. And you can watch it on an app, like on a health app. So it's just fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
I also try this and encourage clients to blend the triangle breathing with short prayers. Flee, Be Silent, Pray by Ed, how do you say his last name?
Szeszky.
He's very, very potent on this. And he's someone who's struggled with anxiety as well. Prayers like Christ above me, Christ below me, Christ before me, Christ behind me, Christ in me, the hope of glory. I actually lengthen that out through 3 cycles of triangle breathing. I think it helps my prayer life, and then it also helps lower my heart rate. So I'll do that before I get up to preach, or if I'm driving in traffic and I can tell I'm a little anxious.
Because everyone gets anxious.
Sure, you're saying that the triangle breathing was really helpful for you in the the midst of a very real anxiety.
Yes, especially at night.
Okay.
I feel like if I'm anxious at night, it can help me get sleepy.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, it calms the brain down through mindfulness, and it calms the body down through the physiological response. That is, you're leading the physiological response.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing you could look up if you're interested is called body scan. Did you ever do that, Elizabeth? I forget.
Yeah, we did it like once, maybe.
Okay, so that wasn't real helpful for you.
It wasn't.
It can be helpful.
Not in order.
For some people. So something you can look up if you want to.
Yeah.
We'll wrap up in maybe 5 minutes or so. 10 minutes? what else do you got?
Well,
I have not seen your notes, so I don't know where you're at.
Well, let me list some of the books.
Okay.
So, like, the first book I got was called The Anxiety Cure by Dr. Archibald Hart. So, he's a Christian, I believe. And his... So, this is, like, basic, like, general anxiety stuff, and also into panic disorder. His main premise is that you need to slow your life down, that modern life is designed to give us anxiety.
Yay.
And we have to, like, institute all these boundaries, and we have to slow down. And so I would say it's kind of just like your basic, kind of entry level anxiety book.
So, does somebody need to be diagnosed with anxiety before this stuff's helpful?
I don't think so. I didn't know.
I mean, I think it's important to know, like, you've never been diagnosed with generalized anxiety. You've never been diagnosed with OCD, but it just seemed to fit.
Yeah.
And that was enough to then start some of the treatment stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
And because the cost of the treatment is nil.
Right.
It's just some, thought exercises, breathing exercises, so... don't wait around. I mean, there's nothing wrong with getting diagnosed, and that, it could be really
if
helpful.
If you want pharmaceutical help.
Sure, absolutely.
You need to, I didn't.
Yeah. And I would say if you're living overseas, it's a lot easier to get a hold of pharmaceutical stuff, but that can get really dangerous really fast unless you're under medical supervision. And I know that in the cross-cultural community, it's very easy to self-medicate.
Mm-hmm.
And if you find that you are taking stuff that would normally be a prescription in your home country, and you're taking it to deal with some psychological stuff here, you got to really push pause and ask if that's actually really healthy, and maybe share with a few people.
Mm-hmm.
And if they raise their eyebrows, you might want to talk to somebody about that.
Mm-hmm.
But I do believe that happens.
Mm-hmm.
You can end up blocking someone from getting the help that they need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But anyway, you don't have to have a diagnosis to do this stuff or to read these books.
No. If you deal with health anxiety, like I did, it's not all in your head. And we'll put a link in there.
Is that a book?
It's a book.
Are you just telling
it's
people
not
it's not
all in
it?
Your head is the name of the book. It's by 2 PhDs. And it was really helpful. It gave practical steps for how to filter through my thought processes regarding health anxiety. So if that's your thing, because we have many different kinds of anxiety, and there is a workbook that I got. It's called the Dialectical Behavior Therapy Skills Workbook for Anxiety, and DBT, Dialectical Behavioral Therapy, is a form of cognitive behavioral therapy. And I haven't even worked through the whole book, but like sections have been really helpful to me. And the main idea that was most helpful to me was like, what in the world is dialectical? Like, I had no idea. It means like, comes from some Greek word or something that means balance. And we're balancing between two extremes. And the extreme talked about in this therapy is acceptance versus change. And acceptance is like accepting where you are right now, and then change is working for change. And I was like stuck not doing either of those. So it's you don't want to like do all the way one or the other. Like, you don't want to just accept yourself and then not work for change. But if you're just, if you're not thinking about who you are right now, like the change isn't, it's like you're denying who you are. So it's like you want to do it at the same time. You accept where you are right now, and then you feel empowered to make changes.
Yeah.
It was just really helpful for me, and I probably didn't explain it very well.
Well, what was the name of the booking? Because that's a really complicated title.
The Dialectical Behavior Therapy. So that's the DBT skills workbook for anxiety. Breaking free from worry, panic, PTSD, and other anxiety symptoms. So that's by a bunch of PhDs also. And that the dialectical thing was just, at first when I read it, it did not make sense to me. And then I came back to it later and it just really blew my mind. And I feel like was like a block I had to work through to start making, I don't know, to be more self-aware, to be more accepting, and to be okay with, okay, I'm not where I want to be, but I'm working towards where I want to be. So that was really helpful. And then we get into like the actual OCD books.
I mean, it sounds like you use this huge variety of things. I just want to pull that out. You're talking about talking with a therapist. You're talking about talking with some friends. You know, about reading, not Google, but some, a bunch of different books. And talking about then also sort of managing your body and exercise and your diet. And this whole sort of multifaceted approach. Do you think that that was, that that's a big key too? In all this?
I do.
You're not looking for just the one golden ticket or whatever.
I don't think there is one one magical thing. And even if you take pharmaceuticals, there are side effects. And it doesn't make everything go away.
It can be really helpful. I mean, medicine can be really helpful to help somebody get to a place where they are not so deep down. And they can actually make a decision and move forward. And of course, we're not mental health professionals, but it... Just want to acknowledge that, too. Sometimes medicine provides a bridge when you're someone who's really incapacitated by what's going on and then and gets them to a spot where they can then actually make some choices.
Make better choices,
So
the main book on OCD is called Brain Lock by Dr. Jeffrey Schwartz. I know Jonathan loves him because he listened to him after I was reading about him and he was like, this guy is so awesome, he knows what he's talking about.
And he's got some great YouTube videos that are really short and sweet.
And there's a, he has some longer ones too that explain it more in depth, but it's really good. It was recommended by a couple different people. And I want to tell my story about Dr. Schwartz because I didn't know that OCD was the thing that I was dealing with in my mind until Jonathan met with a friend of his who's also a counselor, and Jonathan described like what was going on, and he said, I think it, that sounds more like OCD. And so he came home and he said this, and I was like, okay. That's interesting.
And he just said it like, of course. And he was just like, oh, well, that sounds like OCD.
Because he's an expert. And he recommended this book. So I start reading this book and it just fits so well. But then the funny thing was the name sounded so familiar. I was like, I've heard this name before.
The Schwartz?
Yes. Yeah. So back in 2013, I read a magazine article, a Discover magazine article about this guy. And I clipped it out and I kept it. Because he is a Christian, but he his work is secular. But he was being interviewed, and for me, that the big question I had back in those days was sovereignty of God versus free will, and I was trying to sort that out.
And we're not going to answer that on this podcast.
Here was this, here was this science guy, like basically kind of proving that free will existed, that you could make choices to change your brain, and so I kept it. And so I went looking for it and I found it. I was like, this is the guy. This is the guy that like this idea captivated my imagination so many years ago. And I kept it and I put it in my little
you
book.
You had it here?
I had it here. Someone had sent, they used to send us science magazines and I clipped it out. I put it inside this children's book for OCD that a friend had given me when I had really bad anxiety with a pregnancy. And she just said, well, we use this with our kids in our household. I think it could be helpful. She didn't insinuate like, oh, I think this is what you have, but it was super helpful. And I talked about it on I think, a Velvet Ashes retreat at one point. And we can put that link in there too if you want to see it. So I found this and I was like, oh, it's like all coming together. There were like these little threads, but to finally have a name for it was so helpful. Mm-hmm. And with OCD, it's like a version of anxiety that where your brain just gets stuck. Like it gets on a loop and it literally can't shift gears. It's like sticky. Mm-hmm. And then if you do these steps that he gives, it's a type of cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, where you make choices, better choices, and it actually changes the way your brain works. It changes the structure of your brain. And if you do them, yeah, it makes your life better, and it also like changes the structure of your brain without drugs.
Yeah.
So, and that was Dr. Daniel Amen's book too, that was helpful. Like he talks about
change your brain.
It's like change your brain, change your life.
Yeah.
Where you can actually like be part of your own healing. And at first, when I read some of this stuff, I was like, I have to do it myself. I have to fix. I was in a really low spot. But once the counselor got me to just do something nice for myself, it got me a little bit up so I could like deal with these things. And then I could see, like I can make good choices and it can make me happier.
Mm. And that kind of snowballs.
Yes, it totally does.
It's like Dave Ramsey for psychology. Deal with the little things.
They do, they add up. It's so true.
Huh.
Yeah.
So there's hope then, huh?
Yeah.
I mean, it was kind of like coming awake, I think, for both of us, then sort of coming out of that time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people may not, you know, that's not stuff you put on Facebook for the world to see as it's happening.
Mm-mm.
How long would you say that time period was for us?
That it was really bad?
Yeah.
Like 3 or 4 months of what felt like hell.
Yeah, it was pretty rough.
Yeah, and then...
And that was a year ago or so.
Yeah, started like last October. It had been ramping up. I'd been having increased anxiety for probably a year before that.
Okay, it didn't just come out of nowhere. It was
right,
a slow thing.
Right, yeah.
I think.
And probably lifestyle had a lot to do with that. Like,
right.
If you're just rushing around, eating bad food, not taking care of yourself, paying attention to the anxiety and dealing with it when it comes up and just kind of ignoring it.
Mm. I mean, I don't remember any of these things causing a really quick fix.
Mm-mm.
And it might be important to note that these things accumulate, not just like the doing something good for yourself, but the eating changes, exercise mm-hmm. changes. You don't read a book in one day, and you've mentioned like 4 or 5 books.
Right.
YouTube video. I mean, this is a process. I mean, from where I was, it seemed like it was maybe a month or two or three, 3 month process to sort of come out of that time, or what?
Right.
What
would you think? When I started seeing the counselor,
was
probably 3 or 4 months after where it was like really on the upswing. I wasn't like back to my normal self.
So that was like the pivot point, but
still hard. So
when did it get less hard? I mean, like when do you feel like it was okay? It's not done with. Of course, it's not like, whoa, everything's done. I'll never have that again. But how long did it take when you started doing those things?
Probably 8 months.
I think
8 months, yeah.
So just a reality check for our listeners then, that they're not going to learn all this stuff today or listen and then tell the person they love who's anxious and then have a totally better life next week.
No.
I mean, this is, you're talking about lifestyle changes, and relationships are built and eroded sort of over time.
And it was frustrating at the time when I felt like I was trying to do my very best to get better and it wasn't yet. Yeah.
Hmm. So what would you tell somebody who is frustrated that they're not better yet?
Well, I still believe that God is our healer. He heals our bodies and he heals our minds. And sometimes healing is slow. We have this idea that healing is a miracle, like it's instantaneous.
Mm-hmm.
We confuse miracles with healing. But God created our bodies to heal after a cut. So we have this innate healing capacity that God gave us,
mm-hmm.
and that works with our bodies and our minds. And but it's sometimes so slow. And you sometimes need outside help. Like, if you think about, sometimes you need medical intervention when your body is sick and or broken, and you need outside help when something's going wrong in your mind also.
Yeah. So, I mean, I visualize it like sometimes healing happens like this big crashing wave, and it's just all done and it's all healed. And I really believe that that does happen for some people at some times. But sometimes healing is more of a drop by drop, the slow drip kind of thing. But the point is that healing can come.
Yeah.
And that's hopeful.
Yeah.
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 Any other things you want to share?
Well, there's so many things we could talk about regarding OCD for specifics, but if that's your problem, the Brain Lock book is probably the best place to start. And I would say just really fast, two things that were the most helpful with the OCD for me, the obsessive compulsive disorder, is distraction. In the Brain Lock book, it's called refocusing. And this is where you do something else. And so if I was just being nagged by obsessive thoughts of what I need to wash or check or count or any number of things, if I removed myself from that situation, like whatever room I was in, if I change, sometimes all I had to do was change the room, and that changing the physical location could help, but doing something. And sometimes that's exercise, but for me, it turned out to be chopping vegetables because I was on that journey of trying to eat better food, which requires extra work, and chopping vegetables, you don't want to cut yourself. So it requires this distress or this focus on what you're doing. So it was like this whole body, whole mind focus on what I was doing so that I couldn't think about whatever it was that was nagging me. So that's super helpful. I mean, some people could do like other things, knitting, I don't know, something with your hands.
So we eat a lot more carrots and cucumbers now than we used to.
We do. Oh. And the other thing was mindfulness, this idea of mindful checking. So if I have this fear that I didn't wash something or lock something or turn something off, most of the time, you did do those things, and you just have this fear that you didn't, that you can't get out of your head. For me, I would try to, like, instead of just worrying about it, click, 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 click in my head over and over all day, I would close my eyes, slow down, place myself in that moment that I was afraid that, I know, I didn't lock the door or something, and I would go through my motions very slowly, and follow it through and see, did I do this thing? Did I wash it? Did I check it? And so I'm choosing to just do this kind of this thing once. And when I'm done with that and I know that I did whatever I needed to do, I would even say it out loud. Okay, I washed that. I checked that or whatever it was. And that seemed to, like, for me, be enough to stop it. So if you're gonna check, and this is even in the book, I kind of stumbled on this separately and then found it in the Brain Lock book, but if you do the checking, if you're gonna do it, like, do it mindfully and do it once.
Okay.
And then you stop.
Yeah. Good. Well, do you think we wrap up with what's on your heart recently? I mean, this is kind of all this stuff.
Totally.
We're going to try to, at the end of each podcast, say, so what's been on your heart recently?
Sure. It is kind of related for me.
Go ahead.
It is this idea of mindfulness that I think has just been this slow trickle over the last year or so, of paying attention to my body. And I've been disconnected from it and what my body wants for so long. And so learning what feels good as far as, like, even the position I'm sitting in, does this hurt or is this going to hurt me tomorrow? What do I want to eat? I was stuck for a long time in, like, certain foods are bad or I need to eat this kind of food. Even when I was trying to heal from the anxiety I was very rigid about, oh, I have to eat this food and not that food. And now first of all, I feel better, but I try to just like pay attention, tune into what my body wants to eat, and I try to eat that. I think I do the same thing with what kind of exercise I want to do. I just try to pay attention to those things. And it's part of the mindfulness. It's such a big thing, so I feel like I can't explain it very well, but it is like this huge ball of yarn.
Maybe we should do an episode on that. I think something that's been on my heart, and this kind of remains there, is in the cross-cultural world, a lot of times spirituality causes anxiety, or our people's anxiety gets wrapped up in spiritual warfare and what's going on. Again, this Ed Suzeski book, "That Flee, Be Silent, Pray," is something like help for the anxious Christian. We're going to end this podcast with the whole song called "Spiritual Warfare Lullaby," or "Greater Is He." And it's just a reminder, I think, and an awareness that that our God is big, and that He is present in the presence of our enemies, or in His presence. So I would just encourage people, if you're living in hard places or doing hard things, to remember to go back to that place that is strong, that is sort of at the foot of the cross, that is also at the foot of the throne, and remember, even if you don't have it all together, even if you don't understand everything, or even if you feel a little broken, or if you feel like your mind is a little bit broken and something's not working, God remains unbroken and full of love. Maybe this lullaby could speak some truth over you. It has continued to do that for me. So, does that sound okay?
Yeah, I mean, I think that song, it got me through several nights.
Yeah.
It's a really powerful song. That and that Laura Hackett song that you told me about.
What's the name of that one?
Cover Me.
Okay, Laura Hackett Park. Cover Me.
Yeah, we'll put a link in there. But those two songs were like these lullabies, like just telling you not to be afraid.
All right. Well, thanks for listening. Again, this is just episode 3, so we're finding our way, surrounded by our foam mattresses and our concrete box in Phnom Penh, Cambodia. If you have any questions, or if there's something you'd like us to talk about for whatever strange reason, shoot us an email or leave a comment, or however people do that on podcasts. Trottersforone.com is our website. Trottersforone is our Facebook page and Twitter and Instagram and Gmail address. So track us down, let us hear from you, and we'll hope to see you next time.
Have a great week, guys.
All right, see ya.
Greater is He who is in than the one who's in the world. Greater is He who is in me than the one who's in the world. There's no power in heaven or hell or earth that can ever say of God above.